Thank you. Thank you. My lecture is called 9/11, Time for a Second Look. In suggesting that it is time for people to take a second look at 9/11, I primarily have in mind people who decided long ago that the attacks of 9/11 happened essentially the way the Bush administration and the official reports said they happened, and who therefore decided that the so-called 9/11 truth movement, which disputes that account, is composed of crazy conspiracy theorists with no capacity to evaluate evidence objectively. Having formed those views long ago, such people, including most journalists, have been impervious to any arguments presented by the 9/11 truth movement. They simply roll their eyes and move on. However, both the truth movement and the available evidence have changed dramatically in the past 3 years. Because of these changes, it is not rational to reject the claims of the movement out of hand without taking a second look. If you are a person who has had such an attitude, you cannot, in the face of these changes, simply roll your eyes without exhibiting the very irrationality with which you charge those whom you have called conspiracy theorists. My lecture is also addressed, albeit indirectly, to fellow members of the truth movement. Some members have decided now that Bush and Cheney are out of office, and the Obama administration has reversed some of their 9/11-based policies, that getting the truth about 9/11 exposed is not so important anymore. Other members of the movement, seeing that the Obama administration still presupposes that Al-Qaeda attacked America on 9/11, have concluded that there is no hope that the truth will ever come out. So we might as well give up. To such people, I suggest that getting the truth revealed is just as important as it ever was, because many 9/11-based policies, especially the war in Afghanistan, have not been reversed. I also suggest that because of the changes in the political landscape, combined with developments in the 9/11 truth movement, we now have, really for the first time, a realistic chance of getting a real investigation. I turn now to my topic, why official conspiracy theorists should take a second look at 9/11. I use the term official conspiracy theorists advisedly. Quite often, people who believe the official theory about 9/11 speak contemptuously of members of the 9/11 truth movement as conspiracy theorists. But this is irrational. A conspiracy occurs whenever two or more people plan in secret to do something illegal, such as rob a bank or defraud a corporation's customers. To hold a conspiracy theory about some event is simply to believe that it came about because of some conspiracy. According to the Bush-Cheney interpretation of 9/11, which became the official account, the attacks resulted from a conspiracy between Osama bin Laden and 19 young members of Al-Qaeda. The official account is therefore a conspiracy theory, and in fact was the original conspiracy theory about 9/11. What this means is that everyone holds a conspiracy theory about 9/11. Debate about 9/11 is therefore not a debate between conspiracy theorists and people who reject conspiracy theories. It is simply between a debate between those who accept the official Bush-Cheney interpretation of 9/11, their conspiracy theory, and those who accept the alternative theory, according to which 9/11 resulted from a conspiracy within the Bush-Cheney administration. Those who believe the official conspiracy theory, therefore, cannot rationally reject the alternative theory on the grounds that it is a conspiracy theory. To be rational, they must ask, which conspiracy theory is better supported by the relevant facts? We always appreciate applause or laughter because it gives the speaker a chance to get a drink. So. Let me make clear that I do not use the term official conspiracy theorist as a term of reproach. There's nothing wrong with accepting the official conspiracy theory. I did myself for a year and a half. It is only a problem if you are a true believer, meaning that you are so certain that the Bush-Cheney interpretation is correct that you refuse to look at any evidence that might suggest otherwise. One reason why it is irrational to keep believing the Bush-Cheney interpretation of 9/11 without being willing to look at possibly contradictory evidence is that there now exists grounds for being skeptical of this theory that did not exist at the time that it became imprinted on most minds. What a great crowd. At that time, for example, it was not known that the Bush-Cheney administration would tell enormous lies that would lead to millions of deaths, including thousands of American deaths. Besides the lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the White House, after 9/11, ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to lie about the air at the World Trade Center site, saying that it was safe to breathe. They knew otherwise. 2 days before, in fact, the Boston Globe had a story reporting that the air had very high levels of asbestos and other dangerous particles. The EPA was going to say this. The Bush-Cheney White House ordered them to change their statement and tell people the air is safe to breathe. As a result, rescue workers and cleanup workers went out there without even a flimsy cotton mask on, many of them. And as a result, now about 60% of those workers are ill. And if they have not died already, the prediction by many people is that more people will die from the rescue and cleanup than died on 9/11 itself. In the face of this information, it would be difficult to claim that the Bush-Cheney administration would have been morally incapable of orchestrating 9/11 and the subsequent cover-up. We also now have reasons, not widely known at the time, to be skeptical of the official reports. Most people have assumed that the 9/11 Commission was run by its co-chairman, former New Jersey governor, Republican Thomas Kane, and former Democratic congressman Lee Hamilton. They have thought of it, therefore, as an independent, nonpartisan commission. But the 9/11 Commission was actually run by Philip Zelikow. He controlled the 85-person staff which did all the work. And he was in charge of producing the 9/11 Commission report. And yet he was essentially a member of the Bush-Cheney White House. He had worked with Condoleezza Rice during the administration of the first President Bush on the National Security Council. Then during the Clinton years, Rice and Zelikow wrote a book together. Then when she became appointed National Security Advisor under the second President Bush, she brought Zelikow back to help with the transition to the new National Security Council. And then, most important, when she had the job of producing National Security Strategy of the United States of America for 2002, she brought on Zelikow to write it. There had been a first draft produced by a person in the State Department, but she said it wasn't bold enough, so she brought on Zelikow. Zelikow produced an extremely bold, even belligerent document, which said, now that 9/11 has happened, we can no longer honor international law as traditionally understood. According to international law, no country is allowed to attack another country unless it knows that an attack from it is imminent, too imminent to take the matter to the Security Council of the United Nations. Zelikow said, no, now that 9/11 has happened, we cannot wait. So we must have the right to attack other countries before they are ready to attack us. This was a new radical doctrine of preemptive, preventive warfare, which Dick Cheney and other neocons had long wanted. And yet, Philip Zelikow was then put in charge of the 9/11 Commission, which should have been asking, among other things, the question, might the Bush administration have a motive for orchestrating or at least allowing 9/11? Also, we have learned more recently from New York Times reporter Philip Sheehan in his book called The Commission, more things about Zelikow. We learned that in spite of his promises to the contrary, he remained in contact with Condoleezza Rice and also with Karl Rove, the ultimate political operator in the White House, who was intensely interested in the 9/11 Commission, fearing that it might say something that would cost them the re-election. Also, Sheehan revealed that before the staff had its first meeting, before any research had been done, he had written an outline of the final report. Complete, Sheehan says, with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings. Sheehan also revealed that Kane and Hamilton conspired with Zelikow to keep the existence of this outline a secret from the staff. In a book they wrote about the 9/11 Commission, Kane and Hamilton criticized conspiracy theorists because rather than forming their theories on the basis of facts, they start with their theories and then look for facts or perhaps fabricate facts to support their theories. By contrast, Kane and Hamilton said, the 9/11 Commission started with the relevant facts, not with a conclusion. We were not setting out to advocate one theory or interpretation of 9/11 versus another, they said. And yet, they admitted, Zelikow assigned the subject of Al-Qaeda to one of the staff's teams, which was told to tell the story of Al-Qaeda's most successful operation, the 9/11 attacks. If that is not starting with a theory, what would be? If the 9/11 Commission was not independent of the Bush-Cheney White House, what about NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which was given the task of preparing the official reports about the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, and Building 7. NIST is an agency of the Department of Commerce, and therefore, during all the years it was working on these reports, it was an agency of the Bush-Cheney administration, run by an appointee of that administration. Recently, a former employee of NIST has spoken out, saying that NIST had been fully hijacked from the scientific into the political realm. Scientists working for NIST, he says, lost their scientific independence and became little more than hired guns. Everything that came from the hired guns, he added, was routinely filtered through the front office and assessed for political implications before release. Moreover, he said, NIST reports on the World Trade Center also had to be approved by the National Security Agency and the Office of Management and Budget, an arm of the Executive Office of the President, which had a policy person specifically delegated to provide oversight on our work. As a result, NIST reports, which say the Twin Towers in Building 7 came down without the aid of explosives, are political, not scientific documents, as any serious examination of these reports will reveal. The authors, with their PhDs in physics and engineering, could not possibly believe the things they have written. If reasons to take a second look at 9/11 are provided by new information about the Bush-Cheney administration and the official reports supporting its conspiracy theory, the same is true of the new shape of the 9/11 truth movement. At one time, it was dismissed as a bunch of kids on the internet. Then I wrote the new Pearl Harbor, and it was dismissed as a bunch of kids on the internet and an aging theologian. George Monbiot, writing in The Guardian, referred to members of the movement as morons and idiots. Alexander Coburn, writing in Counterpunch, The Nation, and Le Monde Diplomatique, referred to the movement's members as the 9/11 conspiracy nuts, saying they know nothing about the real world, especially the world of military affairs. Lacking any conception of evidence, he added, they represent the ascendancy of magic over common sense and reason. Insofar as critics of the 9/11 movement could, by ignoring many of the early members of the movement, such as a former police officer, a world-class economics professor in Canada, a commercial pilot who had flown 757s and 767s, and an acute historian and many others, by ignoring all those, they could portray me as the head of this movement. Monbiot referred to me as its high priest. Another left-wing critic called me its guru. So they could somewhat plausibly present the 9/11 movement as a religious movement comprised of people who knew nothing about the real world. As one critic put it, Griffin, being a theologian, is not qualified to talk about anything but myths and fairy tales. I did reply that if that's true, I should be eminently qualified to talk about the official conspiracy theory. Nevertheless, the 9/11 truth movement can be easily dismissed insofar as people retain an image of it that was formed several years ago when it could be portrayed as led by people who have no expertise in the relevant fields. Even if that caricature, like most caricatures, contained a grain of truth, then it is now completely false. The intellectual leadership of the 9/11 truth movement is now exercised by scientists and other professionals who definitely know something about the real world. Many of these professionals have formed organizations dedicated to discovering and publicizing the truth about 9/11. A few years ago, some scientists formed the scientific panel for the investigation of 9/11. Other scientists more recently formed Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, the main work of which has been carried out by physicists and chemists. Shortly thereafter, detractors of the truth movement said that if there were any validity to the claims these scientists make about the World Trade Center, they would be able to get papers published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Over the past year, scientists affiliated with Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice have published 3 papers in peer-reviewed scientific journals. The lead author of the most recent of these papers, which appeared in the Open Chemical Physics Journal, is Niels Harrit, a professor of chemistry at the University of Copenhagen. These scientists, who know something about the chemical constituents of the real world, report finding many elements in the World Trade Center dust that should not be there if the official theory, according to which these buildings came down solely because of fire and gravitation, if that were true. A few years ago, after some physicists and chemists had joined the movement, detractors said, "They don't really count. The question of what brought down the World Trade Center buildings is a question for engineers, and your movement doesn't have any." This was in 2005, and that was true. The following year, by the way, some of you heard that interview I did on Democracy Now! When Amy Goodman brought in a hitman. And this became the point of issue at the end of the interview, that he said, "You don't have any engineers." Now, it was true. It was the case that I had located one in Mexico. And I had contacted him and tried to get him to speak out. He decided it would not be prudent to do so. So I had to admit I didn't dare name him. So I had to say, "No, we don't have any." Well, the following year, architect Richard Gage formed Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And as of today, over 600 licensed architects and engineers have signed a petition saying the official story cannot be true. We need a new investigation. These are people who know something about that part of the world that consists of steel frame high-rise buildings. And they know that the official story, according to which fires caused the Twin Towers and buildings to come down in virtual free fall, simply cannot be true. For example, Jack Keller, emeritus professor of engineering at Utah State University, who had been given special recognition by Scientific American, has said about the collapse of Building 7, "Obviously, it was the result of controlled demolition." A similar judgment has been offered by 2 emeritus professors of structural engineering at Switzerland's most prestigious institute, the Federal Institute of Technology. along with hundreds of other engineers and architects that belong to Gage's organization. Firefighters also have expert knowledge that is relevant to what happened in New York City on 9/11. And this past year brought the formation of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, who point out on the basis of their professional expertise why the NIST reports about the World Trade Center should not be believed. As you know, thanks to Alphonse being here, there is also an organization called Veterans for 9/11 Truth, which contains several former military officers. They, I would venture to say, probably know a little more about the world of military affairs than Alexander Coburn. Another professional organization with relevant expertise is Pilots for 9/11 Truth, which includes in its ranks many former commercial and military pilots, including some interceptor pilots, who call incredible the official story about why the 9/11 airliners were not intercepted. This organization has also devoted special attention to the attack on the Pentagon, giving numerous reasons why the official account of that attack simply cannot be true. The latest of the professional organizations to form, indeed it is being formed this very week, is Intelligence Officers for 9/11 Truth. One of the first people to join was William Christensen, a former senior CIA official. If you are one of the many people who just knows that the alternative conspiracy theory is simply too implausible to be worth your spending a day or two to study the evidence, just listen to what he wrote in 2006. I spent the first 4.5 years since September 11th utterly unwilling to consider seriously the conspiracy theory surrounding the attacks of that day. In the last half year, and after considerable agony, I've changed my mind. I now think there is persuasive evidence that the events of September 11 did not unfold as the Bush administration and the 9/11 Commission would have us believe. The backbone of the 9/11 Truth movement is now constituted by these professional organizations of scientists, architects, engineers, firefighters, military officers, pilots, and intelligence officers. And there are still more professional organizations. The past year has witnessed also the formation of medical professionals for 9/11 Truth. And by the way, let me suggest, if you have pen and paper, you might want to write some of these down, because you can go on Google and find them. And if you are a potential candidate for joining these, or you have friends who might be, just go on Google, you'll find that and find out how to become a member. So, medical professionals for 9/11 Truth. Also, lawyers for 9/11 Truth. And this is most important. I'll refer to it again a little later. And of special significance, given where we're meeting and being hosted by the School of Theology, religious leaders for 9/11 Truth. So I'm hoping... Our present goal is to get up to 100. We have got several really prominent religious leaders from this country and around the world who have already signed. And we do have a very impressive set of readings on there by many leading theologians and philosophers of religion. So I encourage you, if you want to do some reading about 9/11 from a Christian or Jewish or Muslim, or and we're working on getting Buddhist and Hindu and other contributions, from that one of those points of view, go on there and find out what is available. Also, very recently, political leaders for 9/11 Truth, which already includes past or present members of the parliaments of Japan, Italy, Sweden, the United Kingdom, and Europe, and a former United States governor. Accordingly, people who have thought of the 9/11 movement as constituted by individuals who can be dismissed as conspiracy nuts, even morons and idiots, need to reevaluate. That is, if they want their opinions to be based on the real world. Here is the present situation, and if you're going to quote any one sentence from tonight's lecture, I would suggest this one. I know it's important because it's in italics. Among independent scientists and professionals in the relevant fields who have studied the evidence, the weight of scientific and professional opinion is now overwhelmingly on the side of the 9/11 Truth movement. Whereas well over 1,000 such people have gone on public record questioning the official conspiracy theory, there are virtually no scientists or professionals in the relevant fields who have gone on the record in support of that official conspiracy theory, except for those who are not independent. That is, those whose livelihoods depend on their continuing to give public support to the official theory. Now, this caveat is most important because of the famous statement by Sinclair Lewis. 1935, he said, "It is difficult to get a man..." Now, this is 1935, so forgive his language. "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." Except for such people, virtually everyone who has expertise in a relevant field and who have seriously studied the evidence rejects the official conspiracy theory. It is time, therefore, for journalists and everyone else to take a second look. Journalists often say they cannot write about an issue that is considered old news. They must have new evidence. Another reason why it is time for a second look is the existence of an abundance of new evidence. There is so much, in fact, that I can only mention a tiny portion of it. Some of this new evidence has amazingly been supplied by the FBI. This is amazing. Yeah, let's hear it for the FBI. Nothing more valuable in the eyes of God than a repentant sinner. Although the FBI was originally the agency that most laid down and defended and protected the official theory, it has recently provided several revelations that undermine this account. One example involves one of the central pillars of the official conspiracy theory, the claim that the attacks were organized by Osama bin Laden. That claim is still used to justify the American military effort in Afghanistan, which President Obama recently encouraged Europeans to support with more enthusiasm. But if you will go to the website of the FBI called Most Wanted Terrorists and look under Osama bin Laden, spell it with a U, Osama, you will find that although he is wanted for various terrorist attacks, the 9/11 attacks are not mentioned. When a member of the 9/11 Truth Movement contacted FBI orders to ask why, he reached Rex Toom, the chief of investigative publicity. And when he asked why not, Toom said, because the FBI has no hard evidence of bin Laden's responsibility for 9/11. Now, I suspect that you in the Boston Globe may have the finest newspaper in America. I mean, by a process of elimination, it cannot be the New York Times or the Washington Post, so it must be the Boston Globe. And surely, therefore, all of you have read about that, right? The Boston Globe didn't talk about this. Another example involves the reported telephone calls from the airliners, through which people on the ground were told that the planes had been hijacked by Middle Eastern terrorists. Some 15 people reported that they had been called by loved ones using cell phones. Now, there were a lot more phone calls, but 15 of them, the people said, I was called on a cell phone. United Flight 93, the plane that reportedly crashed in Pennsylvania, was by itself said to have been the source of about a dozen of these cell phone calls. So it's sometimes called the cell phone flight. Dina Burnett alone reported having received 3 or 4 such calls from her husband, Tom Burnett, from Flight 93. She knew he was using his cell phone, she said, because I looked on my caller ID and I recognized his cell phone number. However, most of these calls were made when Flight 93 was reportedly at 35,000 or over 40,000 feet. But pilots and scientists in the 9/11 movement had pointed out that given the cell phone technology of 2001, successful calls from high-altitude airliners were extremely improbable, in fact, impossible. One of our scientists, Keith Dewdney, a Canadian, who used to be quite well known, he used to write a regular column for Scientific America, so he was considered a credible guy. He decided, let's get empirical, let's test it out. So he got all the cell phones he could find, every brand, and took them up in a single-engine plane and found that they all conked out at about 9,000 feet. Then he went up in a double-engine plane, which has more insulation, and found that they all went out by 7,000 feet. And so you can imagine with an airliner with an enormous amount of insulation, much lower. In fact, most anecdotal evidence suggests that cell phones will not work over 1,000 feet, if that. But defenders of the official story said, oh, no, that's not true. 30,000 Popular Mechanics, you know, wrote a book defending the official theory. And one of its authors said 40,000, 50,000 feet, cell phone calls, perfectly possible. But while Popular Mechanics was making that brave claim, the CIA was pulling the rug out from it. This was 2006. at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, you remember the so-called 20th hijacker, the FBI was asked to turn in all sorts of evidence relating to 9/11. Part of their evidence was a report about phone calls from all four flights. What did they say when they got to Flight 93? They said of the 37 calls from that flight, 35 of them were made on seatback phones, onboard phones, air phones. Two of them only were made on cell phones, and those were made when the plane was just about ready to crash, so it was down at a very low altitude. So you see, the FBI implicitly agreed with the 9/11 truth movement. High altitude phone calls from airliners were not possible. Well, what do we do then about all the people who said, were absolutely convinced they got cell phone calls from their loved ones? You know, many people said, my husband, my wife said, I'm calling on the cell phone. In one case, a person was told that the passenger had borrowed a phone from next seat neighbor. Well, in those cases, you might say, well, they got confused, they forgot, bad memory, whatever. But what about Dina Burnett? She couldn't have misunderstood. She saw the cell phone number of her husband, Tom. And she couldn't have misremembered. She told the FBI that very day, we have the written report. Then she went on talk shows and she talked about this. She wrote a book, talked about it. So what do we do about the fact that she evidently received a call, three or four calls from her husband's cell phone, and now the FBI says, no, he used an onboard phone. Now, this is speculation, but there is pretty good speculation. There is a technology that could explain that, and it was functioning at the time. In 1999, William Arkin, a well-known writer about military affairs, published an article in the Washington Post reporting an experiment, a demonstration that he had observed of the new technology of voice morphing, which allows people to simulate the voice of another person, and so well, in fact, that you could fool the best friend or even a spouse. And he reported that he heard the voice of Colin Powell saying, I'm being treated well by my captors. He heard another well-known general saying, ladies and gentlemen, we have just launched World War III. Neither of those generals had made those statements, but everybody in the room who knew them and knew their voices would have thought it was them. Now, we know about the form of digital morphing, the visual kind, like in Forrest Gump, when Forrest Gump shakes hands with JFK. You know that didn't happen, and yet it was perfectly lifelike. And so Arkin points out, because of digital morphing, we can no longer say seeing is believing. You can see, but it may not be true. And then he likewise pointed out, now thanks to voice morphing, hearing isn't necessarily believing either. Now, what about the phone, the number? Well, there are little devices you can order on the internet, in which it says, fake any phone call you want to. So you can make any phone call appear on somebody's caller ID that you would like it be. So at least it's possible, and to me it seems likely, that that's what happened. In any case, FBI also turned in a report about Flight 77, which is the flight that allegedly struck the Pentagon. And this contradicts the official story even more. That is the FBI's report. The most important of all the phone calls from that day were two from Barbara Olson. That is, two who were reported by her husband, Ted Olson, Theodore Olson, who is the Solicitor General of the Department of Justice. And of course, Barbara Olson was a well-known commentator on CNN. Ted Olson told CNN that day and told the FBI that Barbara had called him twice that morning, that she was on Flight 77, that hijackers had taken over the plane. They were armed with knives and... This is the only alleged phone call that mentioned box cutters. So this gives you an idea how important this story was to creating the official myth or story about 9/11, that we all know the hijackers had box cutters thanks to this one call. Another way this call was very important was that because she was very popular, especially with the right wing, this so outraged America that these evil Muslim Arab terrorists had killed Barbara Olson that people were ready to go kill Arab Muslims. And a lot of people said, you know, it didn't matter too much if they were responsible for 9/11 or not. So this was instrumental to getting the whole psychology, the mentality of the American people ready to support the war on terror. Another way this call was important, there was a rumor that Flight 77 had crashed in the Midwest. The FAA took this very seriously. The FAA controllers had completely lost control, radar contact with the plane, and there was a report of a crash on the Ohio-Kentucky border. These calls reported from Barbara Olson were proof that Flight 77 was still aloft and therefore could have been what damaged the Pentagon. However, when you look at the FBI's report, and you can all read this for yourself, it's on a website, and if you don't know how to get to it, if you buy the new Pearl Harbor Revisited and look in the notes, you can find how to get there. Here is what the FBI report said. They're little graphics, so you can just read, see what they say. And here's what the graphic says about Barbara Olson. It does mention that she attempted a call. But it says, Barbara Olson attempted one call, unconnected, duration 0 seconds. Thank you. This is supposed to create a shock. But I'm surprised. Surely the Boston Globe reported this. This has been public knowledge since 2006. I can't believe it. Now, the reason this is so amazing is that the FBI is part of the Department of Justice. And yet this FBI report was saying that the story told on 9/11 by Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General of the Department of Justice, isn't true. Those calls never happened. That gives you two choices. Either Ted Olson lied, or he was deceived like Dina Burnett. Either way, the whole thing is a lie. It was based on deception. I happened to be invited to the European Parliament last year for the presentation of this new great movie by Giulietta Chiesa, a member of the Italian Parliament, a movie called Zero. How many have seen Zero? Oh, good, good. I would say, if you're talking about full-length movies that cover all the many aspects of 9/11, it and Loose Change Final Cut are now the two movies, and I think they're equally good. They're both really, really excellent. Anyway, I was there, and then they had technological problems, and they couldn't get things to work. So Chiesa leaned over to me and said, kill some time, entertain the audience. So I just started ranting on. And so I told this story, among others, and as I was telling this story, I said, you know, that's an amazing story. This should have been 3-inch headlines, screaming headlines in the Washington Post. But of course it wasn't. But then a few months later, a group called the Freebies, taking off from the Bee Gees, put out a musical, a DVD, called 9/11's a Lie, based on Staying Alive, 9/11's a Lie, 9/11's a Lie. And so I was particularly happy in the middle of that to see the Washington Post with 3-inch screaming headlines. FBI says story told by former Solicitor General is untrue. Well, how many people would still believe the official theory if they knew the facts that I've just revealed to you and the dozens of other facts, if we were willing to stay here a few more hours, that I could tell you about, which the Boston Globe failed to mention? Not very many. This illustrates my point, that most people who continue to believe the Bush-Cheney conspiracy theory about 9/11 are simply unaware of dozens and dozens of facts that contradict this theory. For my final illustration of this point, I will discuss the collapse of Building 7 of the World Trade Center. The truth movement has long considered the collapse of this building to be the Achilles heel of the official theory, its most vulnerable spot. And for good reason. This building came down 5:21 that afternoon. It was not hit by a plane, and therefore no jet fuel was sprayed throughout it to start big fires. Therefore, this 47-story building had fires that lasted only on 6 floors. And yet, it came down in virtual freefall, straight down from a dead stop, just suddenly started moving at freefall acceleration. And it came straight down, and then it ended up in a relatively small, tidy pile. In other words, it looked every bit like the form of controlled demolition known as implosion, where you use explosives to collapse the building from the bottom, then have the walls fold in on themselves, and that's how you get the rather tidy pile. Defenders of the official story clearly did not want Americans to think about Building 7. After 9/11 itself, as far as I know, this collapse was never shown on mainstream television, while we saw the Twin Towers ad nauseum, time after time after time, but no showing of Building 7. Likewise, the 9/11 Commission could not afford one sentence in its 571-page report to even mention that this 47-story building had collapsed. And this was a historic event, being the first time in the known universe in which a steel frame building had collapsed because of fire alone. Surely that would have been worth a sentence. Also, NIST, which had the task of reporting on it, delayed the report year after year after year. Originally, the reports were supposed to come out in 2004, and they said, we're not ready. We'll do it in 2005. 2005, they put out the report on the World Trade Center, the towers, but said, oh, Building 7's going to take a little longer. It'll come out next year. Next year came. They said, no, it'll come out in 2007. In 2007, they said, no, it'll come out in beginning of 2008. Beginning of 2008, they said, it'll come out in August. Well, by golly, it did. The first draft came out in August. And then the final draft came out in November, coincidentally, I'm sure, just before Bush and Cheney were ready to leave office. In any case, my next book, my next book that's going to come out pretty quickly is going to be called Osama Bin Laden, Dead or Alive, and I argue that he's long been dead. And amazingly, it looks like we can pinpoint the date of death, either December 13th or 14th, 2001. One little clue is the funeral announcement of Bin Laden's funeral on December 15th, 2001. And so I'm suggesting that, and also, I mean, the really crucial thing is that as the FBI, as the CIA will report, and former CIA operative Robert Baer, who wrote the book on which Syriana was somewhat based, has said he's checked with his fellow CIA officials who have the task of tracking Bin Laden, and not one of them can say that he's still alive. And that they all say, we have not intercepted another message from him since December 13th. Whereas prior to that, they were intercepting messages to and from Bin Laden rather regularly. And they just stopped on December 13th. So those two things present pretty good evidence. And then, of course, there's the question, well, what about all the audio tapes and videotapes in which Bin Laden has appeared? Well, have you looked at some of those? None of them can be proved to be authentic, and some of them can clearly be seen to be inauthentic. So somebody is faking these things. My favorite is Blackbeard the Terrorist, where Bin Laden, whose beard has been getting grayer and grayer and grayer, suddenly has a purely black beard. These guys are not geniuses. If our news organizations or our Congress were doing one-tenth of their job, this would have been exposed long, long, long ago. Oh, thank you. In fact, I have one of my books. I think it's actually my favorite book of this. It's called 9/11 Contradictions, An Open Letter to Congress and the Press, and I lay out 25 internal contradictions within the official story. There's no theory in this book. You can't dismiss it as conspiracy theory. It's just facts that this person who supports the official theory contradicts this person who supports the official theory on some very crucial thing, like what time did Dick Cheney go down to the underground bunker where he became in charge that morning? Did he go down at about 9:10 or 9:15? As almost everybody reports, or did he go down at almost 10 o'clock, 45 minutes later, after the Pentagon attack, as the 9/11 Commission report says? And that's just one of 25. And if the press had been doing its job, just revealing those contradictions, you wouldn't have to talk about contradictions of laws and physics in the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, just internal contradictions. But they won't report them. An open letter to Congress and the press, and not one mainstream newspaper, magazine, TV station, radio station has even mentioned the existence of a book that is reporting these contradictions in the official story. And they show you just how incompetent these guys were. It is, you know, people say, it couldn't have been an inside job. These guys were too incompetent. Exactly. They were horribly incompetent. It's just the press has covered up their incompetence. But I digress. My next book after this little book is about World Trade Center 7, the NIST report about it. It'll be called The Mysterious Collapse of Building 7, Why the Final Official 9/11 Report is Unscientific and False. And I show in the book that the NIST report about Building 7 confirms what the 9/11 movement has always said about Building 7 It's the Achilles heel, because their report makes clear that a defense of the official theory, a coherent, rational defense, is simply impossible. First of all, they had to commit various kinds of scientific fraud in order even to get their theory, get what looked like a plausible theory. Scientific fraud mainly has three major categories. There's fabrication, falsification, and plagiarism. Now, plagiarism doesn't come into play here because I don't want to be unkind, but I think nobody had said anything stupid enough that these guys wanted to copy. So we're only talking about the fabrication and falsification. But there's one kind of falsification that is extremely important, that is ignoring relevant evidence. NIST had to ignore so much relevant evidence, such as an abundant amount of melted steel in the rubble of the World Trade Center. Now, maybe technically melted iron, which is a byproduct of thermite. But the point is that an enormous amount of steel had melted. Likewise, the World Trade Center dust reveals the existence of an enormous quantity of particles that could have been formed only at extremely high temperatures. We're talking about 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. And fire, as you know, can, an open diffuse fire like this can at most get to 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, and the World Trade Center fires wouldn't have even been that hot. Even Thomas Eagar of MIT says they were probably only 1,300 degrees, 1,400 at the most. So how did things that took 5,000 degrees to melt them, how did they show up in the World Trade Center dust? And as Alphonse mentioned earlier, the dust even includes active thermitic material that appears to be unreacted nanothermite. Now, as many of you know, nanoscience, nanotechnology is the rage now. If you want to get a new building, you apply for a nanoscience or nanotechnology building. There's a vast amount of money for this really popular development. With regard to thermite, thermite is an incendiary. It starts fires. But nanothermite is a high explosive. So it is enormously more powerful than ordinary thermite. And so unreacted thermite, nanothermite, appears to be in the World Trade Center dust. And this is, as Alphonse indicated, an extremely big story that is getting enormous amount of attention already in various parts of the world. Partly because the first author, the lead author, is Niels Harrit, a professor of chemistry at the University of Copenhagen, who is himself an expert in nanochemistry. When NIST was asked whether it had checked the dust for evidence of thermite, and here using thermite in the inclusive that would include nanothermite, it said no. When a reporter asked Michael Newman, a NIST spokesperson, why not, he said, because there was no evidence of that. This circular answer asked the reporter to ask, but how can you know there's no evidence if you don't look for it first? Newman said, if you're looking for something that isn't there, you're wasting your time and the taxpayers' money. I'm not making this stuff up. NIST also ignored and distorted testimonial evidence that explosions had gone off in Building 7. Now, many of those reports came late in the day, just before the building came down. But in some respects, the most important testimony was given by Barry Jennings of the New York City Housing Authority. As soon as the North Tower was struck that morning at 8:46, Jennings rushed, as he was supposed to do, to the 23rd floor of Building 7, which was where Mayor Giuliani had his Office of Emergency Management. He was accompanied by Michael Hess, who was the corporation counsel of the city of New York, and therefore Giuliani's lead attorney. And when they got there at 9 o'clock, they found everybody was gone. They'd skedaddled very quickly, still smoking coffee cups on the desk. So they phoned up, said, "What should we do?" They were told, "You get out of there immediately." So they tried to go down the elevator wouldn't work. They started running down the stairs. But when they got down to the sixth floor, Jennings said there was a huge explosion that knocked the landing out from under us. We're just barely able to hold on. We pulled ourselves up. We went back up to the eighth floor. We broke the window, signaled for help. When I looked out the window, I saw the North Tower, the South Tower, both towers still standing. However, when Giuliani wrote a book about the next year and included a section about his friend Michael Hess's 9/11 experience, he said that what these men thought was an explosion was really just debris from the collapse of the North Tower. Now, that occurred at 10:28. What they were talking about occurred evidently by about 9:15. So we're talking about a difference of an hour and a quarter. How could that possibly be the same event? Nevertheless, this became the official story. It was defended by NIST in its 2005 report and again in its World Trade Center 7 report, and then supported by BBC Special in 2008. Jennings had told his story to the Loose Change producers. It was supposed to go in Loose Change Final Cut. But Jennings said, please don't put it in. It'll cost me my job. They left it out. But then a few months later, Jennings gave an interview to the BBC. But the BBC then distorted his testimony and made it appear like what he was talking about was much later. And so the all-knowing narrator could say what they thought was an explosion was just debris from a falling skyscraper. The BBC even made it seem like Jennings was all by himself, even though he kept saying, "We went down the stairs and then we ran back up." They kept saying, "Jennings, Jennings," as if he was all alone. This BBC show aired in July 2008. NIST, whose timeline the BBC had followed, released the first draft of its report the next month, in August. Shortly before this release, evidently only 2 days from what people have been able to figure out, Barry Jennings, who was 53 years old, died mysteriously. It has been impossible to get any information about it other than the statement that he died in a hospital. Whatever the cause of his death, it was certainly convenient. He was not around to be interviewed again, perhaps by Loose Change. And the BBC was able to put out a new version of its special on Building 7. And this time, Michael Hess participated and confirmed the truth of the BBC timeline, saying, "Oh yeah, this was just debris from the North Tower collapse." Michael Hess had in the meantime become a partner in Giuliani's business. To see the falsity of the official timeline, however, one only needs to look at the interview that Jennings gave to Loose Change, which you can now watch for yourself by going on the internet and looking for Barry Jennings Uncut. In any case, the death of Barry Jennings may well indicate just how threatening the truth about Building 7 is to the official conspiracy theory. I will point out one more way in which Building 7 has proved to be the Achilles heel. I mentioned earlier that it came down in virtual free fall. In the first draft of its report, NIST claimed that the collapse took far longer than a free fall collapse would have taken. It had a theory of progressive collapse and explained you'd still have stuff down there that would resist. You couldn't have zero resistance. But David Chandler, a high school physics teacher, put a demonstration on the web and showed that you could see easily that the building was coming down for over 2 seconds, not just in virtual free fall, in absolute free fall. Then he made a presentation to NIST at a public event that was broadcast. Somehow, evidently, they felt they had to admit free fall. So in the final report that came out in November, they admitted the building came down in absolute free fall for 2.25 seconds. But they didn't change their theory. Their theory was still one that did not allow free fall. So they have an absolute contradiction between their theory and an admitted empirical fact. This contradiction can well be seen as the ultimate self-destruction of the ultimate of the official conspiracy theory about 9/11, which says that Muslim terrorists brought down 3 buildings of the World Trade Center by flying planes into 2 of them. I will conclude by addressing members of the 9/11 Truth Movement, both old members and any new members who may have been created tonight. I am an optimist. Rather than letting up on our efforts to get the truth out about 9/11, now is the time to work even harder. For one thing, the cultural climate seems to have changed dramatically. When my first 2 books appeared, Publishers Weekly, which is the Bible for bookstores and libraries about what books are worth buying, they panned these books, ridiculed them as conspiracy theory. In 2008, November, the new Pearl Harbor Revisited was Pick of the Week by Publishers Weekly. Now, I say that not to brag, but that too. But I say it to stress the difference. Though back in 2004, 2005, it was not okay. A respectable organization couldn't name a book that says 9/11 is an inside job as a good book. But in 2008, that was possible. So it looks like a sea change has occurred in our culture, that this can be a bellwether. Secondly, we have a new president in town, and he has pledged to base his administration's policies on good science and good intelligence. I suggest that part of the 9/11 truth movements now be aimed at the president to convince him that a new investigation is needed. He is a lawyer, a politician, and a religious man. So he may well be moved by learning that these types of people have formed 9/11 organizations urging him to authorize a new investigation. So besides carrying forward all our other activities, we should do everything we can to bring more scientists into the movement, to build up the size of lawyers for 9/11 truth, religious leaders for 9/11 truth, intelligence officers for 9/11 truth, and especially political leaders for 9/11 truth, because this is now what is most needed. Political pressure from political leaders around the world to authorize a new, truly independent investigation through which the truth about 9/11 can be revealed, and so that, and this is the important thing, so that policies based on the Bush-Cheney interpretation of 9/11 can all be reversed. Thank you very much for your patience.
I'll make a few announcements and then I'll call you back up here for questions.
Okay.
Let me give you water on the way out.
Yeah. Thank you.
Wow.